The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
And in this corner, weighing in with his take on current events, the smarty of the party, the mighty Mike from the right, the heavyweight of debate, the man who's in cahoots with the grassroots, the broadcaster master, Jimmy Sangenberger.
Saturday night is always all right for the Jimmy Sangenberger Show right here on News Talk 710 KNUS, and it is indeed such a pleasure and a privilege to be with you once again. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program, and a fascinating one it will be tonight. By the way, if you want to get in touch with me 24/7, 365, you can tweet at me at Sang Center. That's Sang with an E, not an A, Center on Twitter. You can also email me from the 710KNUS website on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show page, 710KNUS.com. And of course, on the contact page at JimmySangenberger.com, my personal website. Remember, there's no A, there's no I, there's no you in Sangenberger. It's all E's all the time. Once you know that, Sangenberger is easy. Plus, you could follow me on Facebook, like the page Jimmy Sangenberger Media Personality at facebook.com/JimmySangenbergerPro. Lots happening tonight. We will talk with two candidates for the state legislature in Denver, Samantha Cook, running for the state house, and Doug Townsend running for the state senate. We will also talk with Bob Andrews vying for the state house himself. That'll be in the third hour of the program. I will check in tonight as well in the second hour with Frank Francone, who is a policy fellow at the Centennial Institute. We're going to talk about a lawsuit in Boulder that could absolutely devastate the oil and gas industry here in Colorado. And related to that, I'm going to share some of an interview I did this week with Tracy Stone Manning, who is an associate vice president at the National Wildlife Federation. She joined me to talk about federal oil leases, oil and gas leases on federal land, which the NWF would like to see halted right now, particularly onshore. We'll get a more left-of-center perspective on oil and gas. That'll be interesting. And this hour, in just a few minutes, I'm going to start. It was just absolutely riveting. Yesterday on Jimmy at the Crossroads, I caught up with Mike Gonzalez of the Heritage Foundation, who has a new book called The Plot to Destroy, called The Plot to Change America. And it really is fantastic, all about identity politics. I was only going to play part of it. It's so good. Such an important and valuable conversation that I want to share most of my conversation in this segment and the next segment with Mike Gonzalez from Jimmy at the Crossroads just yesterday. But first, a quick word. Here's a quick word on what's happening across the country economically. We're starting to really see some improvements, folks. Wall Street Journal: unemployment fell sharply in August and hiring gains moderated as the U.S. economy continues to recover from the steep downturn triggered by the coronavirus pandemic. Employers added 1.4 million jobs last month, helping push down the unemployment rate to 8.4% from 10.2% in July, according to Friday's Labor Department report. The jobless rate's decline, it has dropped from near 15% in April at the beginning of the pandemic, put it below the peak from 2007 to 2009 recession. That puts unemployment in line with past major recessions, though it is significantly higher than pre-pandemic levels. The jobless rate stood at 3.5% in February, a half-century low, just ahead of the coronavirus crisis. State reopenings of their economies helped boost employment this summer, but the gains have cooled in recent months. The economy is operating with about 11.5 million fewer jobs than in February. So it is a mixed bag in that we are still struggling. The economy is still weak, and we still are a far cry from where we were back in February. But the idea that this economy right now, under President Trump, who has been working hard to try and get things opened up as much as possible, at least as much as he's able to do as president of the United States, this economy is in line with previous recessions, and it is not, as the left would have you believe, some type of new Great Depression. It's nonsense to think that this might be like a new Great Depression. It could be if we do another lockdown, but we're not there. 8.4% unemployment, down from 10.2% in July. We're still not where we need to be, but we are definitely further along than where many thought we could be at this point. I remember in May when I debated Mark Cuban, he was like, how are we going to create 3 to 5 million new jobs in the next several months, Jimmy? Well, we've done it and then some. From the private sector creating those jobs with, sure, some government support like the Paycheck Protection Program. But by and large, it's a matter of allowing businesses to get open again. That's the key here. And we are seeing it pan out with an improving economy. The lesson learned must be that we need to get government out of the way and not inject it more into the economy under the guise of helping people to get through it better. Just not the way to go. Let the market work. All right, let's jump into this interview I did with Mike Gonzalez of the Heritage Foundation, author of the fantastic new book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. You want to listen to everything I've got this hour from Mike Gonzalez. Let's roll the tape. What is identity politics really? How would you define it?
Thank you for asking that question. That allows us to start from the beginning. It is a division of society into groups that are based on race, ethnicity, sex, sexual orientation, disability status, anything that confers a claim or a degree of victimhood on a member of the group that allows them to then demand attention or respect or restitution or compensatory justice or any kind of reward. Obviously, one problem with it is that it puts victimhood on a hamster wheel. Although the hamster never tires, keeps running. If you derive rewards and respect from your victimhood, you have zero incentive to solve anything. Much worse than that is that the ideologues, the activists who create this whole thing, mean to have then the groups, the collectives, use that grievance as an incentive to change society. The promise is that though you cannot solve your own problem individually, you cannot end your victimhood individually, you can end it if you act collectively by completely transforming society. That's why identity politics is the thread that it is. That, in a nutshell, is identity politics.
But let's talk for a moment about how identity politics has really manifested itself in the real world right now, Mike.
Well, let's just go back just the last 10 weeks. We don't have to go back the last decade. You have these so-called anti-racism trainings taking place in all agencies of the federal government and across corporate America. They build themselves as anti-racist, but in fact, they're very racist. What they say, and they use charts to say this, they say this explicitly, that hard work or delayed gratification or punctuality or the use of reason is a trait of whiteness. Even the Museum of African American history and culture used to chart saying these things, these very things that I'm describing, until public outcry forced them to remove it and they apologized. But this is being taught, being trained into members of Congress, into members of corporate America, and to feel, to tell, so everything is seen as, all of life is seen as a conflict between the oppressed and their oppressors.
Yes.
So they tell the so-called oppressed, look, you're victims of one of the worst countries in the world. You need to change it. And then they tell the so-called oppressors, no, you are really guilty and you have to apologize, even though you have done nothing wrong. You have to auto-label yourself a racist. This is really something that was last seen in the self-criticisms of the Cultural Revolution. This is happening. Just one last thing. Robin DiAngelo, the writer of White Fragility, who gets $12,000 for $15,000 for a two-hour seminar, recently had a conference call with 184 members of the House of Representatives. She is spreading this this poison to our leaders, and she says herself that she hates capitalism, that capitalism is racist, which is complete falsehood. It's the opposite of the truth. Yes. But she's not the only one. All these consultants, Ibram Kendi, they all say the same thing, that capitalism is racist and we must replace it.
Yeah, well, here's something that's so striking. When we're talking about this idea of diminishing people, which is what's happening. I mean, if you're saying that an individual in a group is part of that group and therefore is disadvantaged, if they think that they are capable of bettering themselves, that's false consciousness. Going to your idea that what's being taught in these seminars for the government and corporate worlds is racist, I think it's a very critical point that gets to the heart of the matter here, is that here on Jimmy at the Crossroads on Fridays, we are celebrating Free to Choose Fridays, which is all about the individual being free to think, free to act, and free to choose. And if you diminish that person down to being part of a group as a part of being an individual who's capable on their own terms, then you are being, in effect, racist towards that person by saying, nope, you are incapable of being better on your own terms. You need our society to do it for you.
Now, this is exactly, you have it exactly right. In Robin DiAngelo, in her book, she says, we must cease to think in terms of individuals. The group memberships was important. So this is a very clear transfer from individual to group member. The unit that has the agency is the group, the collective.
Yes.
The individual may even, they even acknowledge that the individual may be able to improve his own lot in life. But what they say is, if you improve your own lot in life, you're not changing society. What we need to do is change society. They want to change society. They want to. The individual is the legacy of the Enlightenment. We start out with the individual in our founding, in the Declaration, in the Constitution, because that is an inheritance that comes from William Blackstone, from John Locke, from Montesquieu, from all the thinkers of the Enlightenment. The new thinkers, Gramsci, Marcuse, and the founders of Black Lives Matter, Angela Davis, all the people who are leading this charge today, or who have influenced the people who are leading this charge today, are very explicit that they are at war with the Enlightenment. They want to replace the Enlightenment and its values. One of the problems with that is that all our rights, our right to free speech, our right to conscience, our right to free association, will just be thrown out because we got that from the Enlightenment.
Again, we're talking with Mike Gonzalez, author of the new book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. One of the sort of academic ideas that supposedly underpins identity politics is this notion of critical theory, which we're seeing expand into various cross sections of life beyond just the academic world now. I would like for you to please talk a little bit about that, because I think to understand identity politics and where we are at now, and then know where we're going to go and how to stop it, we have to understand sort of the fundamental thinking behind these wrong ideas.
So critical theory is the philosophy of identity politics. If you're in school today, or you have a child in school, and they go into law school, they're studying critical legal theory. In the humanities, they're studying critical race theory. Any critical studies, any ethnic studies, is part of critical theory. So it's completely taken over the academy. It starts out in 1937 with a book by Max Horkheimer and Theodore Adorno called Traditional Theory and Critical Theory. In it, and they describe what critical theory is. Critical theory becomes an unremitting attack, a non-ending criticism of all the norms and traditions of society. Except they don't criticize Stalin and the Soviet Union, even though this is at the height of the famines and the show trials and the massacres. They only criticize the West, the United States, religion, the nation state, and capitalism. But today, it's America and the story of America that is being submitted to an unrelenting, unremitting attack. You see this with the 1619 Project of the New York Times. You see this with all the ethnic studies that are now going to be mandated, K-12 in California, and then after that in California State University system.
What's so striking about what you're describing is that it's sort of like saying the United States of America is a nation that is perpetually sinful. We need to fundamentally change American society, and you really want to get people to think badly about their own country so that they will engage in radical changes, which is why this is so prominent on the left, because they want to change the structure of our society. And so in order to do that, you have to persuade people that fundamentally our society is messed up and flawed.
This is very important, Jimmy. You have to get this across to your listeners. This could do the country in. We're right now, the battle's not over, but we are at a decisive moment. And the people who are promoting this have the wind at their back. And we have to explain the utter racism, the nihilism that is behind all this. This is a thought pattern, a philosophy, which does not believe in truth and falsehood. It believes in narratives that you have a hegemonic narrative, and then you have the counter narrative, and they're engaged in smashing the hegemonic narrative and replacing it with a counter narrative. They have no time for truth. This is Nietzscheism, and in fact, I'm going to blow your mind here. Today, you have the founders of Black Lives Matter, Patrice Cullors and Alicia Garza. Their mentor, their main mentor, is Angela Davis. Angela Davis, a Black Panther member of the Communist Party, her main mentor was Herbert Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse taught her at Brandeis. His mentor was Martin Heidegger, a philosopher in Germany who was a member of the Nazi Party. And what he taught was Nietzsche. He taught Nietzsche in nihilism, and he was very good friends with Nietzsche's sister, also a member of the Nazi Party, and he was himself the head of the Nietzsche archives in the 1930s in Germany. So you have a genealogy that goes from Nietzsche, the biggest nihilist, to the founders of Black Lives Matter today.
Let's talk a little bit about what can be done and where we're at, how far gone we really are, because while it seems like we are too far gone and there's no way that we can turn back the clock, given how ingrained this seems to have become in our government and in our society and in the corporate world and so forth. Are you optimistic? Because it sounds like in your book that you believe that if certain steps are taken, we really can turn back the clock.
Well, I am optimistic. The reason I speak the way I do and I write the things I do is to wake up our population. You know, Milton Friedman used to say, you need to have the right environment of ideas. If you have the wrong environment, even the good politicians will be persuaded to do the bad thing. But if you have the right environment, even the bad politicians will do the right thing. So I'll try to wake up the American public as to what is at stake here. But no, I am optimistic. I think that we can take back the culture and society. We can, for example, we can get the government out of creating categories. Mm. It has no business creating ethnic categories. We should leave that to the scientists, to the anthropologists. We should also stop giving benefits for people to be members of groups. We have just yesterday, I believe, at George Washington University, a professor who came out and said she has passed for being a Latina all her life, but she's actually not that. She is a normal non-Hispanic white, and she did this for benefits. And then in the Washington Post story today, people are decrying this, or her colleagues, and they're saying she teaches Latin American history. I'm just saying, hopefully they'll get somebody else, somebody from the Latin American community. They don't understand that this mindset that only somebody with ancestry in Latin America can teach Latin American history is precisely why somebody lies and tries to pass herself as something she's not. Knowledge, ideas do not inhere in our DNA. That is a very bad, very, very sinful idea to think that that goes nowhere good very fast.
Well, the most it seems that you're allowed to be if you're not part of a particular group is what's called an ally, Mike Gonzalez.
Yeah, that is the question that I always ask. Ally, why? Are we at war? Because you only have allies in a war. But that is their mindset. They see all of society through the prism of a conflict between warring oppressors and the oppressed. And that is not what life is.
Yeah, one of the things when it comes to fixing this problem, to addressing the issue of identity politics that you really spend a lot of time on in your book, The Plot to Change America, Mike Gonzalez, is education. And it's so critical to look at education because we have kids who are coming up in the K-12 public school system who are already being inundated with these ideas. And then when they get to college, it's basically a time to reinforce those sort of ideas so you can go out to the real world and bring this kind of change to society to improve and better society. But the reality is what you are seeing is not just these concepts being talked about, but also in terms of teaching styles. This idea you talk about in the book of culturally responsive teaching, we see that there are achievement gaps between white students and various groups of minority groups of students. And the idea behind addressing achievement gaps under this idea of culturally responsive teaching is not let's help these students to better understand the concepts of math or reading or whatever they're struggling in, but instead we need to teach the ideas differently to that group because they learn differently because of their certain racial or ethnic background. And it just was stunning to me to read that portion of your book because understanding that you need to improve the quality of education, you should come at it from the perspective, let's actually make sure students are learning, not giving them some sort of justification for a handicap, I guess.
It's mind-boggling. It is racist stuff that would make a member of the KKK blush, to say this stuff that that the people of a certain race or group can only think in one way. I just read the report that was handed to Governor Northam in Virginia this week on how to change the educational system in Virginia. It mentions Frederick Douglass, a hero, an American hero, four times. Guess how many times it mentions cultural responsive teaching? Take a guess.
1,000. No, it's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but 80.
80 times.
Gosh.
80 times.
Four for Frederick Douglass and 80 for culturally responsive teaching. We talked a lot about Frederick Douglass on the 4th of July.
Yeah. A hero that should be taught to all our students, an American hero. Now, he shouldn't be secluded in African-American studies. This is somebody who every American should learn when they study American history.
Right. Well, and instead what they do, and the radical left, is they'll tear down a statue of Frederick Douglass because they're not learning about him and what he really did for the United States of America, and especially for the freedom that was needed for slaves.
Right. I get goosebumps even thinking about it. The greatest abolitionist.
All right, time now to take a break here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. When we come back, I'll share more of my interview with Mike Gonzalez, author of the book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free, and so much more up ahead. It's the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. We'll be right back.
rocking and grooving back on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show. Best bumper music known to man. 7 years running here on News Talk 710 KNUS. Little Gary Clark Jr. bringing us back. I want to share more of my interview from Jimmy at the Crossroads, my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner yesterday, with Heritage Foundation fellow and author of the new book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free, Mike Gonzalez.
Education is something that the left has always learned they can and should use in order to make these kinds of fundamental transformations of their societies and their government systems.
Yeah, education is key. And that's why the studies that have been done on what is happening in faculties of education, in schools of ed, they show that their curriculum is completely taken over by critical theory. It is the leading textbook in schools of ed is Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And all I have to say to you is that the former terrorist Bill Ayers, who was with the Weather Underground in the 60s, when he finally beat the rap and found out that he was not going to go to prison, what he decided to do was go to Columbia University, get a PhD on education. And he has devoted himself to educational writing about education and about curricula. This is the way to change society, mm-hmm. not by placing bombs in a business, in a building, but by doing this.
Yeah. Well, and it's important to talk when we're discussing education about what can be done in order to reform it. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Mike Gonzalez, in two suggestions that you make for education. One is restoring civics education in our right. schools, because it's fundamental to understand just the basics of this country. They haven't been taught thoroughly in K-12 right. education. I used to run a nonprofit for several years that worked in K-12, particularly fifth grade, and teachers are woefully inadequate when it comes to resources available to them. They're not making them available, and they're not teaching right. teachers what to teach and so forth when it comes to civics ed, but also school choice. So civics education expansion right. and school choice. Talk to us a little more about that.
For example, you see the complete lack of civics. By the way, civics right now, the left has also changed that. It's taken it away from studying history, studying how America was made, how our government is actually settled, how what the different branches, the division of power. They don't teach that. They teach marching in the street. They teach activism. That is civics to the left. But you see that today in full blossom when you see, for example, the people in the 1619 Project, which is a curriculum as well, and they say that African Americans were not part of the compact in America in 76 or in 87 when the Constitution was debated and written. That is the same argument that Justice Roger Taney made in writing Dred Scott when he denies Black Americans not just a franchise but citizenship. Because he says they were not part of the original compact. That is the kind of racist language that was used by John C. Calhoun, the main defender of slavery in the early part of the 19th century. Abraham Lincoln was so outraged by Dred Scott that he gave a great speech in 1858 in Chicago, in which he said, no, this is completely wrong. He laid it out. He was a great student of the Declaration and of the Founding. So this is completely wrong. The Declaration, all men are created equal, applied to all Americans, applied to all men even. So when you don't understand this, and when your sense of history comes from 1619 or from Howard Zinn, you then repeat the same things that Justice Taney said, yeah. the same racist bad stuff.
But with that, I can't help but scratch my head and be befuddled thinking about how these people are the anti-racists when they're perpetuating this kind of dogma.
I just don't even understand it, because Ibram Kendi, the writer of How to Be an Anti-Racist, he says black and white in his book that you must have discrimination, that you have to have discrimination. And that is, look, we've tried separate but equal during the era of Plessy versus Ferguson, that whole 100 years of Jim Crow. It was awful. There was a lot of human suffering that took place. It was a tragedy. The Civil Rights Act and movement was supposed to get this behind us. The biggest tragedy is that Kennedy's executive order 10925, which first mentions the word affirmative action, and he instructs federal contractors to make sure that decisions are made without regard to race or national origin or ethnicity, then gets turned on its head by his successor LBJ into making decisions with regard to race, ethnicity, national origin, and sex.
Again, we're talking with Mike Gonzalez, just a few minutes left, author of the new book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. And I want to broaden the solutions discussion out to a term that you use in the book called the Civil Rights Movement 2.0. Fundamentally, Mike Gonzalez, what does that mean we need to be looking for from a new civil rights movement in order to right the ship and actually address racial issues appropriately and responsibly?
Well, we have to, for example, and I think this is going to come to the Supreme Court very soon, and I think it will win. We have to end discrimination against Asian Americans. Americans, not mainland, not students that come from mainland China, who are the children of the party cadre, the princelings. I'm talking about Americans whose ancestors were born in China or Korea or Japan or wherever. This idea that they can be discriminated against because otherwise they would enter Harvard and Yale and Dartmouth in numbers that are too high is pernicious. It was set against Jewish Americans in the 1920s. In fact, the same plan that Harvard uses today, according to analysis of it, is the one that is being used against Chinese Americans today. So we need to end this. This would be the Civil Rights Act 2.0, end discrimination. Unfortunately, California, again, a bad example almost in all areas, is considering Proposition 16, which would, again, allow once the affirmative action, which is really, we should call it by its proper term, racial preferences, has been banned by the vote of the Californians. But they keep bringing it back. So now with Proposition 16, they want to bring it back again. The Supreme Court is going to have to step in and end this nonsense because it is bad for the country. The same thing with the doctrine of disparate impact. Disparate impact says that any policy that has a disparate impact on the members of different groups, remember, you can slice these groups any way you want, right? But if you have a disparate impact on a member of a group, even if the intention was not racist, the policy is bad and must be ended. This is just another nonsense idea that has very nefarious consequences. We should end this as well. There are many things like this throughout the government. We should do an inventory of all the policies that we have in this country that make use of this doctrine and ask real hard questions. Is this needed? And I'm sure that in 99, if not 100% of all cases, it would not be needed. We should pursue discrimination. We should go back to Kennedy's idea of making sure the decisions are not based with regard to race, ethnicity, sex, or sexual orientation.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing, though, that concerns me is that there seems to be a lack of will to express the kind of views that we're talking about, except, I mean, I guess it's expanding a little bit, thankfully. We're seeing more discussions that are happening. But at the same time, we're also seeing the corporate world and local communities, local governments start to jump more and more on board with these ideas of the far left when it comes to identity politics and deciding, making determinations proactively that we need to embrace identity politics. Don't we need the will in our society here in this country to actually move forward with a civil rights movement 2.0 like you're talking about? And how optimistic are you, Mike Gonzalez, that we might actually get to that point and sooner rather than later, hopefully before it would be even too late, where we can get more people saying, you know, maybe this isn't the way to go and we need to pursue an alternative path? Because especially with the Black Lives Matter stuff going on across the country, it seems like there are more and more pressures to do the opposite and to pursue identity politics.
Well, we need to expose what is going on. We need to expose who the Black Lives Matter organizations, not the slogan, which obviously is something we all embrace, but the organizations are, which I've done in an essay in City Journal this week. But look, we have to consider that big corporations like regulation.
Yes, because we made that point here before. Yes, absolutely right.
Right. They love regulation because then they have huge barriers of entry towards their competitors. They don't have to compete then with better services and better goods, then all they have to do is compete for investors by cutting corners or offering better services and better products. And we're seeing already shoddy products. Try to call your bank and see how long you're left, you know, waiting, and you're screaming, agent, I want to speak to an agent. And they know that there's nothing we can do. Try to change your provider for cable. So one of the reasons why the corporate world, Fortune 500, might be embracing these things is because they love big government and regulations. They'll be able to thrive. Americans have to understand this.
But one thing relative to that point, though, and I mean, I've made that point many times on this program, because fundamentally, when we're talking about regulation, if a business can pawn off responsibility on the government, say social media companies, if they can say, oh, no, the government said we are not supposed to allow this particular speech, then that gives them an excuse not to allow that speech and just to put it off on the government and not have to face the controversy themselves. But also it does push out the competition, makes it more difficult for others to get in on the market and so forth. So you're absolutely right on the regulatory point. We've made it many times, and Friedman has too. Go ahead.
Let me give you a prime example of this. Yes. 2 weeks ago, Jack Dorsey of Twitter gave $10 million to Ibram X. Kendi, to his center at BU, at Boston University, with no strings attached. What is one of Kendi's most tyrannical proposals is to create a department, a government department of anti-racism, that would only have professional people, no political appointees. They would then apply the disparate impact doctrine, but on steroids, to every policy passed by the U.S. government. And if any policy that is passed shows to have a disparate impact on anybody, then that policy would be rejected by the Department of Anti-Racism. Mm. Obviously, there would also be a speech component to the Department of Anti-Racism. You can see Twitter benefiting from this.
No doubt. No ifs, ands, or buts about that. There are two final points I want to get in real quick, and I really appreciate your time, Mike Gonzalez. Just such a fascinating book and fascinating and critically important discussion, especially to our society right now. One question is, the President of the United States, is there anything that the president himself can do by executive order to address some of the executive branch policies pre-existing, say, from 1977 and 1997, that could help to address this?
The president of the United States, whoever he or she is from any party, can rescind policy directive number 15 by OMB, which creates the ethno-racial pentagon that we have in this country, create mandates at all agencies, categorize people according to these five groups. That was then revised in 1997 to add Pacific Islanders. So we need to rescind both these policy directives and say, you can ask real questions. You can ask a question about national origin. That is a real thing. Cuba is a real country. Mexico is a real country. Ireland and Germany are real countries. You can ask if your parents or grandparents were born there. I would cap it at the third generation. After that, we're all Americans anyway. If you come in and you naturalize, yes, you're an American. You're no longer Korean or German or Cuban or Chinese.
I'm so struck by how far these people have come in succeeding with identity politics up to this point, especially in terms of media, in terms of education, in terms of the corporate world as well, when it is so antithetical, Mike Gonzalez, to the very founding principles of this nation.
It is antithetical to the members, to the quote-unquote victims. And by the way, nobody wants to have their children grow up into victims. What kind of thinking is this? You know, look, this is antithetical to everybody. And the reason why it's as long lasting as it has been is because it relies on myths. It relies on the myth that this is a clamor from the grassroots for recognition. It is nothing of the sort. It was imposed by the grass tops on the people down. It was imposed by activists. It is to this day. The people who benefit from this are the people who work for the ethnic affinity organizations. Another myth is that it is a result, which is a related myth, of the demographic change that came from the Hart-Celler Act of 1965. When these things were put in place, the demography had not changed whatsoever. For example, the first National Advisory Committee on Race at the census came in 1974, when the share of the foreign born in this country was 4.5%. an all-time low.
Yeah.
So these are myths that we have to expose. The reason I wrote my book, The Plot to Change America, was to open people's eyes to these myths that keep getting propagated. And if you think that good nature, good-hearted people in this country think, well, if people want recognition, why not give it to them? But this is not what is happening.
Yes.
And that is why I have written my book, The Plot to Change America, to in detail explain what has happened.
Just a final question for you, Mike Gonzalez. And it is one that I think is to me has been very fascinating, because Marxism has always been, or at least not always been, but for some time was about, let's have the lower class rise up together.
Right.
With common economic interests. This idea is a Marxist, it's still a Marxist ideology,
right.
And you talk about that in your book, but it's different in the sense that it really is breaking people up along these different racial and ethnic lines to achieve similar ends and objectives. But at the same time, what they're doing is they're also fostering divisions within what you would think would be their own leftist coalition. You talk in the book, for example, about feminists versus transgender and the divisions there and how they're manifesting themselves at this point in time. Can you speak just for a moment about the Marxist ideology and the division of people who you might think they might be focusing on bringing them together, but instead they're splitting them apart along these identitarian lines?
Right, because this is an idea that goes back to Gramsci and his theory of cultural hegemony. He realized while sitting in prison that the revolutions that Marx and Engels had promised would be non-ending had never happened, had only happened in one place, 1917, in a European backwater, Russia. And the reason he came up was he thought that the worker had accepted the cultural givens of his society, had accepted religion, the nation state, the economic system. And for that reason, the worker had false consciousness, quote unquote, yes. And needed to go through consciousness raising exercises, which we see today happening across the country, which we talked about earlier. Then Herbert Marcuse came up with the idea. So that shifts from economics to culture. Herbert Marcuse comes up with the idea of working here in the United States that, look, the American worker is pathetic. He's too content. Capitalism has produced too good a way of life. But then he sees the riots and he says, it is with these identity groups that we're going to have a revolution, a long march through the institutions, as one of his disciples, Rudi Dutschke, comes up with. And then it shifts the locus of revolution from the worker to the member of the identity groups. So you could have somebody who's incredibly wealthy, such as Oprah Winfrey, who in a classic Marxist analysis would be one of the bourgeoisie, one of the oppressors. She now, through this alchemy, becomes a victim.
Yes. And what I wonder is how long that can last, how tenable that kind of thing really is.
It depends on how well my book sells. Look, I am optimistic because Marxism relies on a supremely vain, conceit that it can change human nature. It can create the new man. That's a phrase from Che Guevara. But we know from reading the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Bible, that people like Agamemnon and Ulysses and Sarah and Abraham are just like us. They have our same foibles as us. And they lived 5,000 years ago, were depicted 5,000 years ago. So human nature is unchanging. The Marxist, when the new man fails to show up, as the new man always does, he never comes out, then the Marxist must rely on coercion and violence to push through his program.
Yeah.
Americans are too attached to freedom, to liberty, to put up with coercion and violence for too long. That is at bottom, at base, where my optimism lies.
Folks, let's help him sell more of these books. Put it up on the screen one more time, Mr. Matouche. The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. And I cannot recommend it enough because it really does give you a perspective that gets to the fundamentals of how this developed over time and where we are at right now, as well as a pathway. This is what I think was so great, is you really give us a pathway, and we touched on it a bit here, Mike Gonzalez, towards how to reverse this trend, how to stop it now and get back to the cornerstones of this country. So I appreciate your time and the book.
Thank you very much to you and your listeners and your audience for tuning in and for having the opportunity to come on here.
Absolutely. I will definitely want to have you back, sir. Thanks for your time and best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
Once again, Mike Gonzalez joining us, author of the book, The Plot to Change America. Be sure to check it out. I have to tell you, identity politics truly is antithetical to the American ideal. It ignores, it sets aside, it derides the notion that you as an individual are and of right ought to be free to think, free to act, and free to choose. Because it doesn't look at you as an individual. If you're playing identity politics, that means you don't care about the individual, you care about the group. And it is not through some sort of well-meaning motivation either in many of these cases. I'm sure there are some who are playing identity politics because they think it's the right thing to do, because they've been taught that way. But the pernicious thing is that this really is, as Mike Gonzalez puts it, a plot to change America, and it is a plot that we must all be aware of. That goes against the foundations of this country. Once again, I'll say it again because it is Free to Choose Friday. We are and of right ought to be free to think, free to act, and free to choose. And identity politics must be eradicated in order to continue that ideal, to continue the principles upon which this nation was based. We all need to wake up. We all need to study this, read a book like The Plot to Change America by Mike Gonzalez. We need to talk to others and spread the word, because it is not too late, but there might be a point at which we reach that point of no return. Hopefully not, and hopefully we stop it before then, but it's possible unless we all rise up and do our part. All right, that wraps up this, the first hour of the Jimmy Sengenberger Show, but we've got two more up ahead. Next hour, oil and gas. Third hour, we'll continue our interviews with the local candidate series. Don't go anywhere. It's the Jimmy Sengenberger Show, our News Talk 710 KNUS.